thank you so much for making some time for us today. The book is so good.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks. You know, I had to follow up Dick Curlis with Colonel Parker, who might very well have booked Dick Curlis. You know, he did book Yodeling Betty Cody.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Would have signed her, except for her husband, whose name was
Hal Lone Pine.
Yeah, Hal Lone Pine, exactly. And his feelings were hurt that Colonel only was in. And you know, Colonel booked them into the Wolfboro Cafe, which I only know because that's where my grandfather's camp was located, the one that I came to run. It was actually in East Alton, but Wolfboro was and the Wolfboro Cafe was at many times, and I couldn't believe that when I was 10 years old, they were playing the Wolfboro Cafe. Or actually, it was a national act, I think, June Carter. But this is not what you wanted to talk about.
Well, I did want to talk a little bit about Dick Curlis, because we talked so much about him last time you were on, and the wonderful Dick Curlis exhibit at the Country Music Hall of Fame. And I saw some pictures that my friend William Chinnick, Dick's grandson, took, and you and your son Jake were a part of the festivities there. That had to be something else.
It was fantastic. I mean, it really was. And, you know, Terry had worked so, William's mother, Dick's daughter, had worked so long and so hard for this, and it was such a thrill, and we had half of Maine down there for the opening, so it was really great, and great to see Dick get a little bit of the recognition that he so much deserves. And, you know, whenever I talk about Looking to Get Lost, I always say, well, the centerpiece of that book is Dick Curlis. And sometimes people say, great, and sometimes people say, who? or other people will say what Arthur Godfrey said, you know, what's a long, tall drink of water like you coming from Maine, you know, that. But honestly, to me, that was, you know, the epitome of everything that I've always tried to do, whether it's Dick Curlis or it's, you know, Stoney Edwards or Solomon Burke. It doesn't matter whether they're known or not known. And Dick, I hope that I conveyed a little bit of the greatness and the spirit of Dick, most of all the spirit of Dick.
Oh, well, no question about that. And I think that's one of the reasons why he was honored by the Country Music Hall of Fame. Well, when we talked with you about that great book, Looking to Get Lost, you touched on your relationship with Colonel Parker and the notion that, as he said, what he put you on the list.
Well, he did. He did. And he was kind enough. Well, I'll tell you the story. I mean, of how I met Colonel Parker originally. Had just begun the biography of Elvis. I hadn't even begun writing, not even close to it. And I saw that Colonel Parker, who had been on the outside with the estate since 1982 or so, 81, 82, was going to be speaking at the Elvis birthday dinner in 1988, something that I had never attended before and haven't attended often. And when I saw that he was going to be there, I thought, well, I've got to go because, you know, I probably will never meet him. He doesn't do interviews, but at least if I go and I'm in the same room, maybe I can absorb a little bit of the aura of Colonel. And so I went, and I was sitting with the Phillips family. I went with Knox Phillips, who was just one of my dearest friends, Sam's son. And we were sitting there with Sam and Knox and Jerry and their wives. And Sam all of a sudden says, you know, I think I'll go over and say hello to Tom. I ain't going to call him Colonel. He ain't no damn Colonel. And so I, being the well-trained reporter than I am, and I actually have no training whatsoever, but I knew enough to follow Sam to the table that Colonel was sitting at, just a few tables over. And so they met and spoke for the first time in probably 25 years. And Sam, at that point, Sam had never had a high regard for Colonel, except for his ability to get Elvis on the world stage that even at the age of 19 or 20, Elvis knew he wanted to be on. They came to be much better friends following this, but and had much more contact than they had. But the thing was, so I followed along behind Sam. I shook Colonel's hand. And as soon as I got back home, I wrote to him. Well, much to my surprise, I got a reply from him almost before I'd written the letter. Colonel wrote in one of the letters that I've included in this book, The Colonel and the King. He was writing to one of the women who worked in the legal department as a secretary at Paramount. And he said, you know, if I'd answered your letter any more quickly, you would have had my reply before I got your letter. So, and that was pretty much my experience. And we then embarked upon a correspondence, which was of great, brought me great pleasure, great amusement, great enjoyment, and great humiliation, because no matter what I put out there, hoping that Colonel would, you know, respond to my prompts, my suggestions, my requests for information, he would always say, you know, friend Peter, that's how he would begin his letter, I wish I could give you the information you want, but if I did that, I would have to give all my other writer friends the same information, and you can understand why I wouldn't want it. And then he would give me information. It was always helpful. But in any case, so we had this correspondence going, but not long after the correspondence started, I met him in January of 88, he invited me, and I have no idea why. I mean, I'm not going to attribute it to my epistolary skills. I'm not going to attribute it to my good character or my honest face. I have no idea why it was, but he invited me to his 80th birthday celebration in Las Vegas at the Hilton. And it was phenomenal. I mean, I had to take a red eye out and a red eye back, but everybody in the Elvis world, most of all the players behind the scenes, were there. And when it was all over, or when I had to catch my red eye back, which was quite early in the evening, not that early, but I mean, I had to leave the party. And I went up to thank Colonel Parker. And I said to him, and he was engaged in a conversation with Sam Phillips at that point. And it was a conversation, and it wasn't an argument. It was a conversation in which they were going back and forth, hammer and tongs, on every single detail that had to do with Elvis's signing to RCA, of Colonel's arranging for RCA to purchase Elvis's contract from Sam Phillips at Sun. And they were going, they weren't going by the year. They weren't going by the month. They weren't going by the week. They weren't going by the day or even the hour. They were going minute by minute. And each of them was in full command of their facts. And they didn't disagree on all that much, but they did disagree. And they disagreed in the most jovial fashion. And that was really the beginning of Sam Phillips's reassessment of Colonel Parker. But I broke in at one point, after Sam said, you know, you really should join us for breakfast tomorrow morning. We're going to take this up again. And I just was ready to, you know, drop through the floor. I mean, the idea that I couldn't be there at breakfast the next morning. But I was okay. I'd listen to this. And so I said to the Colonel, I said, you know, I want to thank you so much. I'm Peter Gralnick. I really appreciate you inviting me. And thank you so much. And he said, I put you on the list, in this kind of guttural voice. There was no accent. No matter, I mean, he had survived for 50 years without anyone ever suspecting he was Dutch, and he did not have an accent, with age, his voice had grown more guttural. So I thought, okay, he says, I thought he was misunderstanding what I was saying. He's old, he's 80 years old. See, that back then I used to think, I thought 80 is really old. I don't think that anymore.
No.
So I repeated it. I said, you know, thanks so much again. I really appreciate it. He says, I put you on the list. The third time he said, I put you on the list, I thought, you know, there's a message here. And all of a sudden it occurred to me, he had put me on the list. He had essentially given me his imprimatur by inviting me to the party. I met all these people. I didn't tell any of them that I was working on a biography of Elvis. I mean, I was not so ill-bred as to confront them and say, can we have a word here? I just met them. But when I got home, I wrote to them. These were the behind-the-scenes players who I think under other circumstances would never have spoken to me. And I wrote to them, and I think in almost every instance, not in every instance, but nearly every instance, I got to interview them. And it was all because Colonel put me on the list.
Well, the book is wonderful, and the story that you tell, coupled with the amazing collection of letters to and from Colonel Parker. And am I right that it was those letters that served as the inspiration for the book?
The letters were the total inspiration. And you know, I could lie to you and your listeners and say, I worked 30 years in the book. Yeah, I didn't work 30 years, but the book was 30 years in the making, because in 1995, right after Last Train to Memphis had come out, Jack Soden, who was the CEO at Graceland, CEO of Elvis Presley Enterprises, and is still there in Memphis, and is a wonderful guy, and a guy who had a great vision for what Elvis's legacy could become. he doesn't get anywhere near enough credit, but he was a terrific guy. But he called me up to tell me he had read the book, and I'm not going to go on about how great he said it was. I mean, I would get a sore shoulder. I'm not going to do that. But he said, you know, I think that if you were to ask the same question now that you've been asking me for the last 5 years, you'd get a different answer. Well, again, I may be slow on the uptake, and you've already seen this with my meeting Sam Phillips. I mean, my meeting Colonel by trailing Sam Phillips over to his table, and by my not understanding what Colonel meant when he said, I put you on the list. But this time I actually asked the question, which Jack suggested I might ask again, which had been for 5 years, can I get into the archives, which essentially meant getting into Colonel's archives. Mm-hmm. I mean, he kept all the records, every piece of paper, gas receipts, you know, the composition of every show, not just of Elvis's, but of Eddie Arnold's, in every theater and every barn and every place they had ever played. And so I asked Jack, I said, well, can I get into the archives? And he said, yes, as he had indicated he would. And my wife Alexandra and I went down there shortly thereafter. You know, we're ushered into this cavernous warehouse. I mean, the archives, nobody had gone through the archives at this point. We actually, as we went, they were housed in the same dented file cabinets and traveling trunks that Colonel had been using for all these years, but that had been stored in his office and home in Madison, Tennessee. That was, he sold the entire contents of his office and home to Jack for Elvis Presley Enterprises. And so we open up some file drawers. They were very well kept. It's just, we didn't know what the order was. I mean, who would know? So Alexandra we weren't going to stand right beside each other. So she's over in one place in the warehouse and I'm in another. And she's calling me, says, Peter, you've got to see, you know, this letter. And I'm calling to her the same way, because the letters revealed a Colonel Parker that was so different from the Colonel at this, I had known him at this point for 6 years, or 7 years. I had met him in January of 88, this is 95. And I had corresponded with him all this time, and I had enjoyed the correspondence enormously, and I had gotten a real sense of his character. But the correspondence was in the nature of, I don't want to say the put on, it was part of the kidding culture. I've called it the kidding culture, which prevailed in advertising. And really, it was the most good-hearted thing in the world. I had an uncle named Jonas, my grandfather's brother, great-uncle. And he was at the top of the advertising game in Boston in the 40s and 50s. And it was exactly the way he was, the way he and my grandfather, who was a teacher, an English teacher, they were together. And that's the way Colonel was with me. The letters showed so much greater depth. They had so much more detail than I had ever seen before. And they also exposed, and I'm not saying I saw this all at once, but they exposed a degree of vulnerability and sensitivity, which, as I got into them, really astonished me. And I said to Jack Soden, CEO at Elvis Presley Enterprises, I said, we've got to do a collection of Colonel's letters. And he agreed, and we were going to do it. But at that point, Lisa Marie Presley sold the estate. And that set off a chain of circumstances. And it took me, at that point, another 25 years to get back to it. I mean, here we are 30 years later from the time I first saw them. And in the process, the book changed a great deal. And the simple way that it had changed was, I knew Colonel Parker's widow, Loanne. I had met her, I met her at the 80s in 89. And I didn't know her very well. But we stayed in touch, and she invited me to the Colonel's memorial, which was a terrific, it was just a very moving affair. And, you know, and I was as thrilled to be invited to that, although I was sorry for the occasion, as I was to be invited to his birthday parties, the 80th and 85th. But so I had known Loanne, and I talked to her about this book I was doing. And basically, and this is a shorthand, she signed on to it. She was as anxious as I was to see Colonel, or more so, to see Colonel get his proper place in history, which I felt strongly then and feel strongly now. He never did, and she felt even more strong. Now, Loanne was as loving a wife, or as loving a spouse, as I've ever met. Nobody could have loved a husband more than she did. And if and she admired him even more, or at least as much as she loved him. And yet, in the course of our talking, we spoke, she would write me things, she felt absolutely committed to the idea of telling the truth, even if the truth was painful. And sometimes it is, you know. I'm not going to tell you the truth right now. Too painful.
But it's fascinating to me, though, the image of Colonel Parker that he cultivated, and the reality that you've learned through the course of the research, the letters, and talking to so many people. Why do you think his reputation was so different from reality? And was that in some way self-protection for Colonel Parker, to not let people behind the curtain?
Well, I think partly. I think there are two. We can speak for the next week or so on this.
I would love that.
No, I think one thing to understand is the colonel's reputation in the business was as the greatest manager there had ever been, essentially up until Elvis's death. There were some cracks in it in the last few years. And fundamentally, where the cracks came from was the colonel was committed to the idea that the artist, and he always referred to Elvis as his artist, not as his boy, not as, you know, there was no, this was his artist. He put all of his faith in his artist and all of his faith in his artist's judgment. And he defended Elvis's artistic choices at every stage from the time they first met. But the artist always wears the white hat. And if there's any blame to be taken, it has to be taken by the manager who wears the black hat. This is in terms of Western movies. Now, towards the end of Elvis's life, as Elvis's behavior grew more, let's say, erratic, or, you know, his stage performances, I mean, without assigning any blame, that's just the way it was. Colonel, there was certainly some blame that attached to Colonel, but it really wasn't until after Elvis's death, and Colonel was managing the estate, he was Vernon Pressley, with whom he worked very closely over the years. The only three people who knew Elvis's business, the only three people who were ever in the room were Elvis, Colonel, and Elvis's father, Vernon. And they were present for everything, and nobody else was ever in the room. And Vernon said to Colonel, "Will you please carry on?" when Elvis died in 77. When, I'm getting to the point here, I promise. But when Vernon died, and I can't remember if it was 80 or 81, it was somewhere in that time frame. Lisa Marie, Elvis's child, was, let's see, she was born in 68, so she was 12, I think she was 12 years old when Vernon died, and she didn't become a ward of the estate, but the Chancery Court, I think it's the Chancery Court in Memphis, stepped in and appointed an ad litem guardian to look after her interests. The ad litem guardian, I think, was sincere. I don't think he understood the business at all. But in any case, he wrote a second report, which excoriated Colonel Parker for things that I'm not sure the ad litem guardian fully understood. And so there was a succession of lawsuits that went back and forth between the estate, which had no interest in suing Colonel, but which was forced by the court to sue him. I mean, I'm not making this up. This is just the way it was. And eventually it was all settled in 82. But by the time it was settled, Colonel's reputation was in tatters because he was seen, in the terms of the report, as someone who had done nothing but take advantage of his artist. One simple example of the misunderstanding was that the ad litem administrator, guardian, he said, look, here's Elvis Presley, the biggest artist in the business, and the colonel never improved the royalty rate that Elvis got from RCA. It never went up for 5%. It went up every year. I mean, there's a record of it, but it went up in ways that weren't always in writing or always fully recorded, but they were always fully paid.
And always designed to protect both Elvis and Vernon so they wouldn't get hit with a big tax burden.
There was that, and there was also the fact that every major artist, and I'm sure it's true today, has or had a most favored nations clause.
Right.
But let's say if you're if I you and I if you're signed for $5,000, you've got a most favored nation clause, and I get $10,000, then you unless the company is completely dishonest with you, you get $10,000. So for Elvis to get more than 5% would have, in any case, that was a total misunderstanding, and the amount of money that Elvis got from RCA was so far beyond what any contemporary artist got from anybody. But every one of Colonel's rewrites of the contracts was no more than 4 pages long. It was a letter to Elvis from the company. And there are a number of letters in the book, which I'm sure you saw, in which Colonel is writing to one RCA executive or another. And he was friendly with all of them. He says, it's great that you know what it hasn't been put down in writing, but we have to be certain, you may not be around forever, and we have to be certain that the next person who comes in also knows what these terms are. And they always did.
It's interesting, too, that Colonel, throughout his life, talked about the fact that he and Elvis had a partnership and that neither one would have been as successful without the other. Elvis always agreed with that. And the understanding between them was certainly strong. There were maybe toward the end, there were some questions from Elvis and those around him, but Elvis certainly understood the phenomenon that became Elvis Presley was not possible without Tom Parker.
I think that friction is what there was between Elvis and Colonel at the end, and it was based on a number of things. And I'll come back to what I think the primary thing was based on, what the people around Elvis imagined. And again, this isn't saying anything bad about them, but none of them knew what any of the deals were. None of them knew what any of the understanding. None of them were in the room, and they all admitted it. And they were devoted to Elvis, and some of them, like Jerry Schilling and Joe Esposito, after a while, were, and Alan Fortas also, were quite close to Colonel, very close to Colonel, and didn't have the view that some of the others did. But the basic thing that happened, the reason for the friction, there's no question that Elvis and Vernon felt that Colonel Parker, he wasn't their good luck charm. He was able, as everyone in the business would agree, there was a reason Brian Epstein wanted to meet Colonel Parker. That meeting recorded slightly in the book. But the Vernon, there was no doubt in Elvis and Vernon's mind that Colonel Parker would make more money for Elvis than anybody else could. There's no question in my mind. And it didn't, forget about the percentages, which changed to some extent over the years. But the friction arose from the fact that you had two people, and this is what I got from Elvis's widow, Loanne, and this is what really came as a shock to me. I had always imagined that Colonel Parker was what Jack Soden called a lovable rogue, someone who, in the terms that I wrote about him in the past, could rise above any adversity that arose. And if he lost $1 million at the roulette table, I could only document he lost $800,000 at a time at the room. But if he lost $1 million, he could just shrug it off. In fact, that's true. He could just shrug it off. He didn't care about the money. But he was, as Loanne told me, and this is what came as a shock to me, a gambling addict to the extent that not long after she entered into, she both went to work for him and entered into a personal relationship with him. And not long after she entered into that relationship, she said to him, "You care more about the gambling than you do about me. I think we should go back to just a strictly business relationship." And I've got other things in the book which describe his gambling addiction as he hears criticism from his closest associates, like Tom Diskin and Al DeVorin, and I'm trying to think who, and Freddie Beanstalk. And he just, with Tom Diskin, who was his oldest associate, he says, "Get out of my sight. I don't want to speak to you." And he didn't speak to him for, he was not. So he had this gambling addiction. And Elvis had this addiction to prescribed medication. And both of them knew of the other's, faults, vulnerabilities, addictions. And as Colonel said when he was interviewed by a lawyer for the commission that was looking into Elvis's death, it had nothing to do with him, but it was just all, as he said, "Whenever, if I ever tried to bring up Elvis's problems with him," and he tried to did several times, "Elvis would say, 'What about your problems?'" And the two of them were at a kind of standstill. And this is not the basis for a good relationship. And that basically, they should have, each of them should have walked away. I mean, listen to me. I've got such great advice for it. But I mean, it would have been healthier for them to walk away, and yet neither one of them could, because in some ways, the dedication and the love that they had for each other continued to apply. And also the sense, I think, on both of their parts, on Colonel's part, that he would never find or encounter a greater artist, on Elvis's part, that he would never find anybody who could work to a greater advantage for him. And so that was really the real issue.
We're talking with Peter Guralnick. His wonderful new book is The Colonel and the King, Tom Parker, Elvis Presley, and the partnership that rocked the world. As always, Peter, phenomenal research and going back and tracing the early years of Colonel, his journeys to America before settling here. And I thought it spoke volumes about his character. The whole relationship with Eddie Arnold, who became, and maybe people don't remember this, but he was the biggest star in country music for a time, and Colonel responsible for so much of that. But
until Taylor Swift.
Right. Yeah. But when they went their separate ways, it was still an amicable parting, and they would continue at times to work together through the years. Yeah. And Eddie Arnold continued to speak glowingly of what the Colonel had done with him. And to me, that spoke a lot about him.
Yeah, about both Eddie Arnold and Colonel Parker. And when Eddie Arnold's talk at Colonel's memorial was so dignified and so full of respect, not over the top. Eddie Arnold was not the guy to go over the top or to minimize the fact that there were differences of personality. Unlike Elvis, Eddie Arnold was able to decide, this is not the way I want to be represented by this guy, this flamboyant, extroverted, although as Lo Ann said, he was an introvert who worked so hard to be extroverted. But he, truly, the story, and for fans of country music, you know, could recognize this. If Colonel Parker's story had ended before Elvis entered the picture, it would be one of the most extraordinary stories, you know, that you could ever read. What he achieved with Eddie Arnold was essentially a template for everything he achieved with Elvis. And Eddie Arnold was a superstar that such as country music had never seen, and as I say, would not see again, at least until Garth Brooks and Taylor Swift. Prior to her pop, you know, crossover. But it was just an astonishing achievement. And his early work with Gene Austin, who had been a pop superstar in the 20s, you know, whose My Blue Heaven was the biggest selling single of all time until White Christmas.
Right.
His early work with Gene Austin, when he knew nothing about the music business, and put to work this was back in, I think, 1938, maybe 39. Colonel knew nothing about the music business when he went to work for Gene Austin, when he started running the tours, and Gene Austin was kind of down on his luck, and he did an extraordinary job for him and put into effect all the lessons he had learned from working in the carnivals and circuses.
I thought that the whole Hank Snow story was fascinating as well. I worked a little bit with Hank Snow late in his career at a festival here in Maine, and he was... I will say a little difficult to deal with at that point. And I thought it was very interesting that Hank Snow,
he was a little testy.
Yes, and thought for sure that with Colonel, that he was going to go along for the ride and reap some of the benefits from this Elvis Presley phenomenon.
Oh, unquestionably, yeah. And I think of all the people, I mean, to be fair, there was not a single person that I spoke with or that I'm aware of who did business with Colonel, who did not respect his integrity totally, except for one person. I mean, Colonel, you know, I spoke to people who were both high up in the music business, like Julian Aberbach, or people at William Morris, or just people who were everyday promoters, who could be promoter in Maine or something. And every single one of them said that when you were dealing with Colonel, you could deal on a handshake basis. His word was his bond. There's no question whatsoever. He came through on every contract, everything. The one person who could complain about it was Hank Snow, and legitimately. And Hank Snow, without going into the details of it, I think never knew what hit him. You're right. Mm-hmm. Hank Snow believed that Colonel was a kind of maybe a loudmouth or a yokel or something like that, and Hank Snow was going to gain the advantage. Well, I don't want to, actually, I don't even want to say that. I don't think there's any blame to attach to Hank Snow. They became partners. But what happened was, I believe, that almost as soon as Colonel Hank signed Hank Snow, which was in December of 54, the next month he met Elvis, and he saw an artist who was so much greater than anybody. I mean, as much as he believed in Eddie Arnold, he believed that Elvis had a vision which was going to carry him to a place that nobody else had ever gone, artistically. And Hank Snow, as you say, had a vision of Hank Snow. I mean, he was an extraordinarily talented person. I love his music. But he did not have the expansive vision of Elvis. And I think also Colonel saw, here's a guy who was, if he wasn't in his 40s, he was nearing his 40s. He was right at that. And who had an established career. What Colonel wanted to do was do what he had done with Eddie Arnold, build somebody from scratch, build a career, and build just from a solid foundation. And he really bamboozled Hank Snow. I can't figure out what happened. Hank Snow could never figure out what happened. But in essence, their partnership came down to the fact that, yeah, they were partners in promotion. They were partners in putting on shows, but they were not partners in Elvis Presley. And it's true, they weren't. But Hank Snow thought they were. Nonetheless, Colonel and Hank Snow remained on very good terms, both business and social, with Colonel for the next 5 or 6 years. I don't know why. I can't for the life of me figure out why. But because he had been really left at the altar when Elvis was signed to RCA. He did not participate in that at all. But he continued to send songs to Colonel for Elvis. They continued to be on good terms. Colonel contributed to charities that Hank Snow was promoting. So it's a very odd story. But of all the people, he's the one person who had a legitimate complaint. And I think Colonel behaved in a way that was not characteristic in any way of any of his other dealings.
The 1968 special, which Colonel never called the comeback special, interesting there because the stories often portray Colonel as an obstacle. And what you found out from talking to a number of people is that that was not really the case at all.
No, he was totally a cheerleader on that. Again, he believed in Elvis. When Elvis performed at the benefit performance in Hawaii, a benefit performance for the USS Arizona, which is an amazing performance and exists in the world, in the lowest fi in the world. Everybody should listen to it. Colonel booked, he was so blown away by it, or so carried away by it, but most of all, blown away by how invested Elvis was in the performance and how much more he got out of it than he was getting out of the movies he was making. Colonel booked a nationwide tour of either 38 or 42 cities in partnership with RCA. That would have been in 1962, and he canceled one of the movies Elvis was scheduled to make for MGM. RCA backed out of the deal, and Elvis didn't perform live again until the 68 special, but this was something Colonel believed in very much. Very briefly, Colonel, Elvis had run out of movie options, and he approached, Tom Sarnoff at RCA, and made a deal where Tom Sarnoff would pay, I believe, $1 million total for a movie and a television special. The television special would have been a Christmas special. Colonel believed in Christmas specials. Right. He believed in Christmas singles. Elvis's biggest album of all time was his Christmas album. I mean, it's obvious to anybody why a seasonal release is good, because the season does not just exist this year, it exists next year, the year after, you know, forever. So a Christmas special was fine. Early on, before the creative team was ever hired, Colonel met with Singer's artistic director, Al DiScipio, whom I'd never heard of until after I finished Careless Love. And a guy named Bill Bram did an interview with him, which is just a fantastic interview. Al DiScipio came into that meeting with Colonel, with RCA, and NBC. Those are the four entities. And Al DiScipio came in and said, you know, this Christmas special is all very well, but this special should you know, exalt, should celebrate Elvis's artistic achievement and the fact that he revolutionized American music. At this meeting of the four entities involved, Colonel Parker said, signed on totally. Subsequent to that, the creative team was hired of Steve Binder and Bones Howe, and they did a great job, but they never fought Colonel Parker. There was no opposition from the Colonel. He was on set practically every day. He was fooling around. He would play a game called Honesty with the producer, Bob Finkel. And Honesty consisted of something like, you know, my saying to you, can you guess the number I'm thinking of? And you'd be, and he would say, no, you're wrong. You know, he was like Stephen Colbert. He says, and Bob Finkel would be wrong 10 times. And then the 11th or the 15th time, Colonel would fork over some money to him that he guessed right. And they had this thing going on. That was the extent. Everybody on the set saw Colonel as a benign experience, including the music director, Billy Goldenberg. But they didn't. He had nothing to do with the creative element. That was all Elvis. Right. And Steve Binder did a great job of filming.
Yeah, we had a chance to talk with Steve Binder a few years ago, and he had some great stories. One of the legends, the myths of Elvis, too, is that the reason he didn't perform overseas is that the Colonel was worried and didn't have a passport, was not an American citizen. And what you learned is that while that may have been part of it, in a big way, it was Elvis who wasn't crazy about going to some of these places.
Well, yeah, I mean, in fact, there are a number of phases of this. One thing is in the late 50s, and up until 1960, Colonel was planning a world tour, which revolved around Elvis going to Australia for a protege of his called Lee Gordon. Weirdly enough, and it's hard for people today to imagine if they read the newspaper, getting a passport was not a big deal. It was not hard to do. In the 50s or 60s, the American artist, Willem de Kooning, came to this country in 1926, same year as Colonel, came as a stowaway, same as Colonel, arrived in the same port, sailed from Rotterdam, same as Colonel. Mm. He didn't get his citizenship until 1962, de Kooning. He was world famous. Traveled to Venice in 1959 for a celebration of his work. I mean, I'm not an expert on, but I would guess that you could get a passport by producing a driver's license, which Colonel did have, and that many people's. But in any case, Colonel thought of he was talking about a world tour, which would have started in Australia as late as 1960. It went away in the 60s, and there are a number of reasons for that. But what you said is true. Elvis's interest in going to Europe, returning to Europe after his army service, Priscilla Presley told me, and she said, you know, when Elvis was with the guys, he kept saying, I really want to go. I mean, because they were so enthusiastic. Eventually, he gave Joe Esposito and Jerry Schilling and their wives a trip to Europe. I think they went to Greece. They had a great time. So, and that they took his place. But Priscilla said, with the guys, Elvis was so enthusiastic about the idea of going. When he got behind closed doors, he just said, I don't want to go there. He loved his life here. He loved his life. When he finished with a film, he went right back to Graceland. He enjoyed that. In the 70s, when he was touring, I think at that point, it would have been difficult for Colonel to accompany him to Europe, because by then the requirements for a passport, although God knows why he wasn't a citizen, given that he served in the army and married a U.S. citizen. I mean, this is inexplicable, but he was not. But he would have been happy, I believe, to have sent Elvis abroad with Tom Hewlett, who was the person really the biggest expert. He's the guy who, with Concerts West, pioneered in the rock tour with people like Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix and all the big stars with Creedence Clearwater.
But there were also some concerns, too, by the 70s that Elvis would have trouble getting through customs because of the pharmaceuticals that he was carrying with him.
Well, this is what Tom Hewlett said explicitly. And Tom Hewlett was not a colorful guy. He wasn't an over-the-top guy. He just looked at things as they were. And he's, you know, he said to me, and I'm sure he said to other people, that who was going to carry the drugs through customs. I mean, Elvis's guys were devoted to him, deeply devoted to him. But, you know, being devoted doesn't mean you're going to go to jail for somebody. And what good would it do? Colonel always referred kind of cryptically to what the problem would be. He just said security. We couldn't get the security in Europe. And most people might have thought, oh, you mean the people, the security guards weren't trained for, but that wasn't what it was. What he was talking about was Elvis's security. And so that was absolutely, and Tom Hewlett, in fact, took the Moody Blues to Japan in, I think, 1974, came back. The guys were just thrilled at the idea. Now, Tom Hewlett, you know, when they wanted to talk to him about what Japan was like, they were excited about Japan. They thought Elvis would love to go to Japan. And then Tom Hewlett went up to talk to Elvis in the suite. And he said Elvis was interested in hearing a little bit about the Moody Blues tour, but exhibited no interest whatsoever in going over himself. And I think that's the real truth.
August 16th, 1977, I was a young radio guy and heard what in those days was the bells ringing on the AP teletype, and went down and ripped that news off the wire and read it on the air that Elvis had died at the age of 42. And I guess I should have known this because we knew he was going to be in Portland, but the Colonel was actually in Portland, Maine when he got the news about Elvis.
He was. Now, where were you?
In Bangor.
In Bangor, Dick Curlis's home territory.
Right.
Colonel was in Portland, and I mean, the portrait that I didn't talk, in the past, for Careless Love, I spoke to a number of people about Elvis's death. In this case, this was Colonel's story. And Loanne, his widow Loanne, painted a portrait of a man who just went into shock, was so devastated by the loss. And he put on a stoic face. Not only did he put on a stoic face, he had dinner with everybody who was in Portland with him doing the advance work. He told them, we have to keep up appearances. You know, we can't shed any tears. We can't show any grief. We're still working for Elvis. We represent him. On the flight to Memphis, he issued an edict. You know, he didn't want to see any tears. And at the funeral, he issued a further edict. And this devastated Loanne, his wife, that nobody should wear any clothing that was different from what they would wear when they were working for Elvis. So Loanne wanted to go out and buy a dress for the wedding. All she had were her road clothes. He wouldn't let her. He sent Tom Hewlett back to his room when Hewlett showed up in a suit, you know, to go to the funeral. And so there's so much in the book. There are so many instances where Colonel's emotional connection with Elvis is clearly evident. There's a time just a couple of years before this when Elvis is appearing in Hartford and it's a disaster. And Tom Hewlett told me about the show. So that Loanne, who was on the tour, she was the secretary for the RCA Record Tours, you know, said it was just awful. And Colonel went to see Elvis, as he did a number of times, really to confront Elvis as best he could with, maybe he would just say the show has to improve. And he came back to Loanne and he said, I don't think he even recognized me. Yeah. Or he could barely speak. This is not the friend that I know and love. When is my friend going to come back? And he burst into tears. Again, the most unlikely thing you could ever imagine. It's the most unlikely thing you could ever imagine if you were somebody who had preconceptions about the Colonel. It's the most unlikely thing I could ever imagine, given a certain amount of knowledge of the Colonel. And yet, and that's the way he was. And he went down to Tampa from the, you know, from Memphis after the funeral. He was also devastated. He volunteered to Vernon that he would run the funeral, as he had Gladys's. And when Vernon said to him, no, we're going to take care of it, Colonel was, it wasn't that his feelings were hurt, but I mean, it's almost like he'd lost his place in life. Now, Vernon the next day said, I want you to carry on the business. So it wasn't a break in a sense, but Colonel wanted so much to do something meaningful for Elvis and continued to want to do that for the rest of his life.
Well, it's such a fascinating story. And again, what we thought we knew about Tom Parker is only a small part of the story, as you've discovered. And I think what I came away with, among other things, is that in his realm, in his area of expertise, he was as much the king as Elvis was in the world of music and rock and roll.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, there was no, listen, if I could have a manager, I'm probably too stubborn to have a manager, but if I could, I'd love to have Colonel looking out for my business. On the other hand, I would carefully scrutinize every line of our agreement, not because I would think he was dishonest, I mean, but because of the fact that he was a very canny person. He would live up to everything he promised, but I would want to know what it was he was promising, and I believe it would have been good things, but he looked out for Elvis. He looked after Elvis. I don't want to romanticize him. I don't want to say, oh, he never made a mistake or he never looked out for himself. He certainly looked out for himself, but in ways that are not quite, that are not at all the terms that people think of him in. And he never lost his belief in Elvis. I mean, in a way, the worst example of his belief in Elvis, he believed Elvis could rise to any occasion. Aloha from Hawaii was giving Elvis a challenge. Elvis rose to it. The last special Elvis did, the CBS special for 1977, when Colonel was doing everything he could to keep Elvis off the road, when he's writing letters to Vernon and Tom Hewlett and Tom Diskin about, I don't know what we can do. And he's writing letters to Elvis saying, are you sure you're ready to go back? He set up this 1977 special. He got $750,000 from CBS. He never believed they would pay it. It was an incredible amount. He was convinced, and he was wrong. He was totally wrong. This was a very bad misconception. But he was convinced that Elvis would rise to the occasion, that given that challenge, he would get himself straight. And the result was something that hasn't been seen officially, hasn't been released since 1977. And it's heartbreaking to see Elvis like that. I think it is going to be released, or my understanding is at some point. But and maybe it'll be different, than, you know, maybe it'll look different. But I remember watching it, and I've seen it since. And it just,
it's painful to watch.
It's painful. And yet it was not Colonel trying to make money off of Elvis. It was that he truly believed, because this was the greatest artist he had ever encountered, and somebody who he truly believed Elvis would rise to that challenge. But he was wrong.
The book is wonderful. The Colonel and the King, Tom Parker, Elvis Presley, and the partnership that rocked the world. Read the book, read the letters, because they tell such a story as well. Peter, it is so good to talk with you again. You are an American treasure, my friend, for the work you do.
I don't know about that. Listen, it's always good to talk to you. I enjoy it so much. And, you know, it's good to talk to you. In terms of your leading the conversation in directions that I don't fully anticipate. So I hope I didn't, you know, screw up too much. And I hope you didn't give me too much of a challenge, but I really enjoyed it.